We're in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 11. You could turn to Daniel 11, starting in verse 36. That's where we'll be starting eventually. Got a little ways before we actually get into it. This Thursday evening, July 11th, we're going to be doing something special. We're going to be participating in something that actually quite a few churches are doing. We're going to be hosting the premiere of the new Greg Laurie film, Hope for Hurting Hearts. Here's a sneak preview.
Mountains high, valleys low, these are the things that make us grow. But all I wanna know is if you can hear me. And all I wanna know is if you're still listening, God.
It was that day I felt robbed.
When I heard the news that our son had died,
I can say that I've been in a place where I feel hopeless.
I read about the blind man seeing and the deaf hearing.
I felt as if someone had taken a big eraser to the chalkboard of my dreams and just erased everything.
I felt like I could literally die.
I'm not supposed to be visiting the graveyard of my wife so young.
Does he love me? Does he hear me? And when I was searching for him, he didn't answer me, so I felt alone.
And give me the faith I want to believe. Believe.
I think instead of asking the question, why?
I believe.
We should be asking the question, to whom shall I turn? You need to turn to God. He is the hope you're looking for.
I said, I believe.
I found myself being almost gathered up into the heavenlies with the Lord.
I just raised up my hands. And I've never to this day felt the presence of God so thick.
So why don't you shine? Come on, shine on me.
I hit bottom and God was there.
Heal me from the greatest disability of all, death.
Even I don't understand, I can't see, it's dark kind of, I still believe.
Every promise that he ever spoke to me, everything I'd ever read in the scriptures was real.
And God was there, and faith kicked in.
And you'll give me the faith I know to believe.
The hardship you're going through right now, the crisis you may be facing, need to know one thing. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, God is in control.
Seasons change, well, I change too. Like spring and summer, then I fall back to you.
Maybe you're going through a difficult time. Maybe you've got a hurting heart. I encourage you to come on Thursday night. It could be that you know someone who's struggling. Invite them to church. Say, hey, we're going to show a special film on Thursday. Hope for Hurting Hearts. Please come with me. God has a way out. God has help for you. So that's this Thursday night. Now, Daniel chapter 11. We're now in this last section of Daniel. It began with Daniel fasting and praying, and an angelic visitor shows up. The visitor brings to Daniel an amazing batch of prophecies that look into the future of Daniel's people, the Jews. Last week we saw the amazing details laid out of the various kingdoms that would one day fight against each other. Now this is all in our past. Now some 2,000 years later, this has all been done, the first 35 verses. These kingdoms covered the period of history from Daniel's time until that of Antiochus Epiphanes up to about 150 BC. In particular, we saw battles between the kings of the north, or the Seleucid rulers who ruled centered in Syria, versus the kings of the south, the Ptolemaic rulers who were centered in Egypt. And the reason that Daniel is being told about these battles is because the people caught in the middle between the north and the south were the Jews. And so God's letting them know about the difficult things that are ahead for them, so that when they happen, they're not caught off guard. They're not wondering, well, what happened? What did we do? What's wrong with us? No, God's saying this is what's going to be happening. This is what's ahead. You just be ready for it. Last week in verses 31 through 35, we covered a period of history known as the Maccabees, when a small group of Jewish patriots outnumbered in every battle stood up against the Syrian oppression of Antiochus Epiphanes. And they gave the Syrians one defeat after another. I was reading yesterday in Josephus. Oh my gosh, the battles, one after another, sometimes outnumbered 5-1. Absolutely amazing the things that God did through these Jewish patriots. When we cross from verse 35 to verse 36, there's going to be a huge gap of time. In fact, the gap is even still going, because we haven't reached the events of verse 36 yet. This isn't the only time in Scripture that happens. You will see this in various prophecies in the Old Testament, where it prophesies about a certain number of things, and then even in the middle of a sentence, it skips thousands of years. This is nothing new. It's nothing new. Why do we think that there's this gap? Let me give you, I think I've got four reasons. First is the phrase in verse 35. He uses this phrase, the time of the end. In Daniel 11:35, we did this last week. Some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, make them white, until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. This phrase, the time of the end, indicates something different than what we've been reading. Surely the end didn't happen with Antiochus Epiphanes. Things kept going. Secondly, there's a phrase in the upcoming verse we're about to read, in verse 36. It talks about a king who, in verse 36, shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. We're going to see this coming up in the next verse. The 7-year tribulation period is known as the time of God's wrath. And so we're going to read about a king who will prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, till the end of the wrath. This person will be around at the end of the tribulation, which has not happened yet. Third thing that we will see, we will get to this next week. There's a phrase in chapter 12, verse 1, which is still part of the same vision. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 are all one whole package. You got to take them all together. Don't just take them as separate chapters. They're all together. In chapter 12, verse 1, there are some similar prophetic markers. It says in chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, at the time that this last batch of things are happening, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. There's a couple of time markers in there. It talks about the time of trouble. The time of Jacob's trouble is the tribulation. There are terms in verse 2 that talk about description. The word asleep and awake speaks of resurrection, which is what will happen in Revelation chapter 20, verse 4. There will be a resurrection after the tribulation period. So these are more time markers that show us that we've skipped somehow into the future. And lastly, this next section is filled with things that haven't happened yet, unfulfilled prophecies. It's at this point that you can no longer... Remember last week how we were matching these prophecies in the history, and how, I mean, it seemed more like a history lesson to me last week, but it was actually when it was given to Daniel, it was all in the future. And yet it happened. Boom, 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 boom. One thing after the other. Well, at this point, starting in verse 36, the things never don't seem to match the historical past. After Antiochus Epiphanes did his abomination of desolation, where he sets up a statue to Jupiter in the temple, he gets rid of the altar, he sacrifices pigs in the temple of Jerusalem, the Jewish temple, pigs. That's not very kosher. You're tracking how, like, that's the abomination that leads to desolation, which, by the way, was fascinating. I came across this yesterday, that is abomination of desolation. The desolation lasted for 3 years, very close to the 3.5 years of the tribulation period. But after he does this, Antiochus Epiphanes takes his armies off to fight in Babylon, and that's where he dies. He gets some kind of disease and dies. He doesn't do the things that we'll see described in this next section. While the prophecies that we talk about today, in this section, we'll talk about battles between the king of the north and the king of the south. And as far as I've found, as far as what I've come across, after Antiochus Epiphanes, and I remember at the end of last week, he was chased out of Egypt by the Romans. And after that point, his kingdom gradually fades and gets smaller and smaller, until by the time of Jesus, there is no Syrian or Seleucid kingdom. The Romans thought they were too dangerous, and so they absorbed them and scattered them, got rid of them. Now, not so with Egypt. But there was at this point no more north and south battles, which we will see today. So, unfulfilled prophecies. So, chapter 11, verse 36. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. The king shall do according to his own will. What king is this? This is the Antichrist. We'll just put it out there. That's who this is. This is talking about the Antichrist. And we're going to see stuff. Remember last week I was talking about, I wonder about these poor beaten up Jewish people in Israel. What are they thinking? It's all these things. They're probably going, I wish somebody would ask us, because we'll tell you what's going to happen next, you know, because it's all coming. Well, you know what? We're now in that place, because some of these things have not happened yet, but they will. Well, except I kind of don't think we'll be around to tell anybody, but that's another story. He's the Antichrist. He is the little horn mentioned in Daniel 7, verse 8. We've covered all this stuff. He is the prince who is to come in Daniel 9, where it says, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's talking about the Antichrist was the people of the prince. The Antichrist is the prince who is to come. And his people, the Romans, would destroy Israel and the sanctuary back in 70 AD. That's a whole nother, Daniel chapter 9. He is the beast of Revelation 13, who is indwelt by Satan himself. He is the one who is given authority by 10 kings, Revelation chapter 17. A few weeks ago, my pet side reading project, I've been reading about Winston Churchill.
Yes, yes, Winston Churchill, very good, very good.
And but he died. He died 2 days ago. Actually died in 1965, but in my life, he died 2 days ago when I finished the book, and it was very sad. But I came across this interesting historical nugget. I don't know. I'll just throw this out. This is a who knows. There was a seed planted which eventually would grow into the European Common Market and eventually become the European Union. The seed was planted on May 5th, 1949, when Winston Churchill, this is after World War II, when he guided Europe into signing what was called the Treaty of London. Didn't do much itself, but it was a seed that planted European, that suggested European unity, which was unheard of. You want to guess how many nations signed this treaty? 10. I thought that was interesting, because I hadn't seen that before. I thought that was fascinating. Oh, well, anyway, the beast is given authority by 10 kings. Verse 36, he shall exalt and magnify himself. He shall exalt and magnify himself. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about humility. We don't really want to learn a lot from the Antichrist other than be not like him. We want to learn humility. The Antichrist will be following the path of his mentor laid out for him, Satan. We read this about Satan in Isaiah 14. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Satan is the epitome of pride. And the Antichrist will be indwelt by Satan. And it says, he shall exalt and magnify himself. He's the guy who likes to toot his own horn. Now, it's not always bad to toot your own horn. Way down on the Mississippi, two tugboat captains who had been friends for years, they'd always cry, I, and blow their whistles whenever they passed each other. A new crewman asked his ship's first mate, why do they do that for? The mate looked surprised and replied, you mean you've never read in the Bible where it says an eye for an eye and a toot for a toot? Sorry, it's the only funny thing in here today. I'm sorry. I had to sneak something in here, a groaner. Okay. For most of us, tooting your own horn can lead to trouble. Winning the race. Oops. Celebrated a little bit too early. Yeah, pride's not a great thing. The Bible says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up.
I think the emptiness happens when you get to the place that you thought would make you happy and you discover it doesn't. Or the emptiness happens when you continually strive to get to that place and don't quite reach it. It's two different kinds of emptiness, but it's emptiness nevertheless. I remember in my early years as a pastor, my drive to preach the best sermon every week I possibly could. And I would have people come up to me after the sermon saying, oh, that was great, Pete. How are you going to top that next week? And I would just think, oh, no. And I would be working all week long and all day Saturday. And I'd be there late Saturday night and early Sunday morning. And I was just dying. It's exhausting having to succeed. What I didn't realize is, as that was my focus for so long, and that was my drive for so long, that I had just worn myself out. When I was a little guy and people asked me, what do you want to be when you grow up? At first, it was a fireman, and then it was a policeman. But then around 10 or 12, my answer became very different. Every time someone asked me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said the same thing. I said, I want to be the best. And they would look at me and say, the best at what? And I would say, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I just want to be the best at something. I think it came from the fact that I liked attention, and I noticed that the kids who were really good at things got more attention than the kids who were less so. And so at the core of who I was, it was really about people thinking highly of me and just feeding off that attention. There was one basketball game when I scored 52 points, and I was the best player on the court that night. And I remember going back in the locker room and people patting me on the back and getting changed and going out, and everything was still the same as it was before I scored 52 points. And I thought, dang, it isn't as good as I thought it would be. It didn't meet the need that I felt I had. And so I needed to find something that was, or someone that was. Christ is first in my life because he is magnificently first in everything. And it's simply my recognition of who he is. He is first because he's better than me at everything. Anything I can try to do, he can do it better. He's first because he passionately loves me. There's nothing I can do to make him love me more. There's nothing I can do to make him love me less. He loves me perfectly right now. So he is first in my life because he's passionately crazy about me, whether I'm doing well or not, whether I'm performing beautifully or not, whether I just sinned miserably or not. He's nuts about me. He's crazy about me. How can someone like that not be first? When they make you first, he made me first in his life. He went to the cross for me. He thoroughly sacrificed himself for me. He made me first. And when I come to grips with that depth of love, with his passion for me, it seems incongruent to allow anything else to be first. He's got to be first. I'm Pete Briscoe, and I am second.
We need to be careful when we want to just draw attention to ourselves all the time. Get people to notice us. You don't want to be falling into the trap the Antichrist does, exalting and magnifying yourself. God, help us to walk in humility and to love the Lord. Verse 36, the Antichrist says, he shall speak blasphemies. In Revelation 13:5, it says, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. That's 3.5 years. That's talking about that last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And he shall prosper, verse 36, till the wrath has been accomplished. He's not going to go on forever. He won't prosper forever. There will be judgment. Asaph writes, this is in the Psalms. Asaph writes, this is interesting, watch this. Psalm 73, he writes, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful, when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Sometimes we get like Asaph, and we see how wicked people seem to make out okay. You know, and we wonder, how come they don't get caught? How come they just get wealthier and get more stuff, and everybody loves this wicked person? How does this go on? Why should I keep living for God when I watch this other person totally screw things up and everything goes their way? Doesn't seem fair. You read on down in chapter 73 of Psalms, it says in verse 17, and he struggles until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. You and I can get angry at wicked people who get away with their wicked deeds, but we ought to be sad for them. Because there will be a day when they will no longer get away with it. It may not be in this life. Don't misunderstand me. It may not be in this life. They may be able to trick everybody else into letting them do all their mess. But friends, there will be a day when they will face judgment. It's when Asaph came into the sanctuary. You know, it's when you open up the Bible. It's when you come to church. And remember the perspective. You know what? There will be judgment. There will be judgment. There will be a day when they will stand before God. You know, my friend, if you haven't turned your life over to Christ, you too will one day face God face to face. And you will face a time where he will judge you for all that you've done. Are you ready to face him? If you haven't opened your life to Christ, then you're not ready to face him. But if you open your life to him, if you ask for his help, ask for his forgiveness, well, the Bible says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten son of God. There is judgment coming, friends. And the way you escape the judgment is by holding on to God, by holding on to Jesus, because he paid for your sins. Receive him. Verse 37. This Antichrist, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. Now, it says he shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Now, some have suggested that what this means is it's hinting that he could be Jewish. And in specifically, he's a non-practicing Jew. There's some other hints in Scripture that we even think he may even be from the tribe of Dan. That's a whole other rabbit trail. I won't go down that road. But he is the one who will be proclaimed. They will think he is the Messiah. So it would kind of make sense that he would be Jewish. Some suggest that all this is talking about is that he's an irreligious man, which fits our society where we do everything to separate church and state, right? Something like that. It says he will regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. There's a couple of possibilities here let me throw out. In ancient Jewish culture, the greatest thing that could ever happen to a woman would be having the honor to give birth to the coming Messiah. That would be considered the greatest of honors. And so perhaps when it says he does not regard the desire of women, it means that he doesn't regard the Messiah, that he doesn't care about Jesus. The NIV translation says he will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, talking about the Messiah. So some suggest that that's what it's talking about. It could be that he's a single man. He doesn't have a desire to be married, and he's more interested in politics than women. That's another suggestion. And a third one is that he could be homosexual, that he doesn't have a desire for women. Those are possibilities. Verse 38. But in their place, he shall honor a god of fortresses. And a god who his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. This god of fortresses, the idea is that with his growing wealth, he will invest in military strength. Perhaps it even might be even more specific, things like some of these new defensive technologies that the U.S. and Israel are developing, things like these missile interceptor programs. The idea of a fortress is a defensive thing. The idea that he's investing in defense, possibly, and he will honor with gold and silver. So whatever this god is, he will honor by spending a lot of money on it. Verse 39, thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Now it says he'll act against the strongest fortresses. So the idea is that he's going to take on the world with the help of his God. He won't be afraid to challenge the strongest of nations. John tells us in Revelation that the Antichrist is connected to Satan himself, and that he will actually cause the world to worship Satan. That sounds like a foreign god to me. Revelation 13:4 says, so they worshiped the dragon, that's Satan, who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, the beast is the Antichrist, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him. You see how those two things are connected? The worship of the foreign god and military, making war with him. in verse 39, it says he will acknowledge this foreign god. In verse 39, it says, with the help of a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. Now, it could be that he's advancing the knowledge of Satan. Other modern translations have a little different twist on it. They say, those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rule over many and shall divide the land for price. So another alternate way of this is that the people that hang with the Antichrist, he pays them back and takes care of his own. It says he will divide the land for gain in verse 39. You know that one of the issues that is at the core of the Middle East problems is what to do with Israel. Now, the Arab countries all have a solution, and that's to get rid of Israel, but I don't think that's going to happen. What do we do with Israel? Every American president seems to try to tackle this. What are we going to do with Israel? And the idea of partitioning up the land, dividing the land for gain. Perhaps the idea is that the Antichrist is going to figure out how to finally stop the Israeli-Palestinian problem and perhaps do it with financial incentives. That could be one of the ways that you take this. And certainly that is one of the things that has been tried, is between Europe and the United States. We pump some cash into both Israel and to Palestine to try to get them to get along with each other. So perhaps that might be what this is talking about. Verse 40. Now here's where we're looking at the future newspapers. Verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Now, it mentions that this takes place at the time of the end. I believe that these next set of events are taking place in the last half of the tribulation period, the last 3.5 years before Jesus comes back. It says, the king of the south shall attack. Up until verse 36, remember the first 35 verses, everything we did last week? Up until verse 36, the king of the south always referred to the ruler in Egypt, while the king of the north always referred to the ruler in Syria. North and south were relatively based on the fact of north and south of Israel, right? That's why we're calling them north and south. I think we want to be careful that we don't stay handcuffed to the idea that north always refers to Syria and south always necessarily refers to Egypt, though they may. It is kind of interesting that right now, have you noticed that there are things happening in Egypt right now? That's kind of fascinating. I'm not trying to say anything about it other than it's just interesting that Egypt's in the news right now. Another turnover in their government. Currently, Egypt has a pretty long-standing peace treaty with Israel. I don't know if that will change. This kind of hints that there will be a day that it will change. It kind of sounds like that the South may, and if this includes Egypt, who knows? We'll watch the news. It's just curious. It's just, you wonder what's going to happen. And it mentions the South shall attack him. Most of the time in this passage, I believe the hymn will still refer to the king of the north because of the context. We've been talking north and south. The south will attack who? It'll attack the king of the north. But I don't think this is any longer the king of Syria. I believe this is now the Antichrist. We've kind of been talking about this. And I believe that the new map now looks like this. The south is maybe Egypt, but the north, because we've already identified the Antichrist from the other scriptures as being the ruler of a revived Roman Empire, which would cover the area somewhere around Europe, we think. One suggestion. By this time, the Antichrist will have entered into a 7-year treaty with the nation of Israel. Because that happens at the beginning of the tribulation, the beginning of the 7 years. We see that from Daniel chapter 9:27. He shall confirm a covenant with the many for 1 week. Do you remember that? Remember back in Daniel chapter 9? The Antichrist will come up with some type of a treaty with Israel. Europe and Israel. Right now, Europe isn't the friendliest with Israel. They're a little more friendlier with the Palestinians right now. So as an ally of Israel, when Israel is attacked from the south, because we're halfway into the 7 years, and if the Antichrist has a treaty with Israel, this covenant, which we've saw back in Daniel chapter 9, then he has to come back. He's got to come down and help them from the north. You follow me? Did I lose you? Did I have to go? I'm not going to go over this. Sorry. You have to get the notes and figure it out, okay? It says he'll come with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. So he's developed this great military industrial complex, and he'll move down towards Israel to help Israel because he's allied with them. Verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Says he shall enter the glorious land. That's Israel. Because of his treaty with Israel, the Antichrist will respond to help Israel. He'll bring his troops into Israel. But it mentions, and he'll overthrow many countries, because if he's coming from Europe, he's going to be covering some territory as he's entering into Israel. But it mentions Edom, Moab, and Ammon, the most prominent people of Ammon, shall escape from his hand. The Antichrist will not cross into modern Jordan, which is these ancient territories of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And actually, does anybody know what the capital of modern Jordan is? Amman. Guess where they got the name? Doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure that out. It comes from the ancient peoples of Ammon. Amman, Ammon, same thing. So when he enters Israel, he won't be breaching the borders of modern Jordan. It's at the halfway mark in the 7-year tribulation when the Antichrist sets himself up as God in the temple. Remember the abomination of desolation? We've covered that several times. Halfway through the tribulation, he sets himself up as God and wants to be worshipped. Jesus said that when that happened, the Jews living in Israel at that time needed to head for the hills. He said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay, now follow me here. The abomination of desolation takes place halfway through the tribulation period. Jesus said, by the way, you know, when you see that happen, head for the mountains, leave. Vamos, the mountains. I'd like to suggest to you, gang, that the mountains he's referring to are the mountains east of the Jordan River, modern Jordan, and they are mountains. When you travel to Israel, did you guys go down to the Dead Sea? Spend time in the Dead Sea? And you look across the Dead Sea, you see these big hills off through the haze. The mountains of ancient Edom in particular is what you're looking at down by the Dead Sea. Isaiah hints in a very cryptic passage. He says, send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness to the mount of the daughter of Zion. I don't want to go into the explanation of how we get there, but what this is talking about is that a gift will be sent to Jerusalem from the people hiding in Selah, which is the ancient city also known as Petra. When Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, he says, flee to the mountains, which is this area here. Now, the Antichrist will be coming down from the north, but he won't hit Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Now, one of the places we know that they will be hiding is Bozrah. That's Isaiah 63. But Isaiah 16 hints at Selah or Petra. You know that place from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. This is Petra. Antichrist has this treaty with Israel. Israel is attacked, and he shows up to rescue them, like a Messiah should. But at some point during this period, when he goes into the temple, which will have been rebuilt, and declares himself God, the ones who have figured out what's going on will flee Israel across into modern Jordan, where they will hide out in places like that. Verse 42. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now, power over the treasures, perhaps some kind of control over the economies of these countries, of Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. These three countries, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, when he's attacked, when Israel is attacked from the south, he responds and conquers these areas that have attacked him. He attacks, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. The word for Ethiopia in Hebrew is Cushi, which some have suggested refers to the Persian Gulf nations. That's just as another possibility theory out there. Who knows? Verse 44, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. It is possible that the news from the east might include the huge army that is hinted at in Revelation chapter 9 that comes from the other side of the Euphrates River. The number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them, and some have suggested this might be the armies of China. So he hears rumblings. Verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. It says he will plant the tents of his palace. The Antichrist will relocate his headquarters to Israel. He had been ruling over Europe. Now he's going to relocate his headquarters to Israel. And the most likely location is in Jerusalem, which is located between the seas, the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. But it says he shall come to his end, and no one shall help him. Because Jesus will return, and the Antichrist will be thrown into the lake of fire. Revelation 19 says, then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. Last thing I just want to end with is this thought. Hope. Now, follow me. If Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 35, last week, if those things were fulfilled so incredibly accurately, what do you think the chances are that today's passage will be fulfilled? I would say it's pretty good. I mean, we only covered about like 10 things in our passage today. Last week, we covered like 50 things. I mean, and they're all done. Boom, 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 boom. Check them all off. God's to-do list. And they're all checked off. And yet what we're coming up with now is the future. Do you think it'll happen? It will happen. I think this passage is meant to be an encouragement to the Jews living in these coming days, just like the previous passage was for the Jews living in the time of the Maccabees. The encouragement says this: don't worry, it will all be over. It will all be over. And that evil guy is going to get what's coming to him. It will be over someday. Are you facing difficult times? Because I got news for you. There will be a day when it's over. It doesn't all end and we all die and go to hell. It kind of doesn't work that way. If you're trusting in Christ, yes, yes, there may be a day that you're going to die. Absolutely. But you go to heaven. In the end, it's okay, gang, every once in a while to look at the end of the book and see who wins. God wins. And we're trusting in Him. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, which is our troubles, but at the things which are not seen, which is the coming hope. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. It's okay, gang, to skip to the end of the book. God wins. Let's stand and pray.